Welcome to XX Science. It's in your genes. Today is Friday, May 10th, 2013. I am Adrian Rorick, chemistry editor, and with me today is Emily Willingham, editor-in-chief at XX Science. Emily, other than XX Science, what activities do you do, or where can our readers and listeners find your other work?
Let's see, my other work appears primarily now on my personal blog, which is emilywillinghamphd.com. I also have a blog on the Forbes blog network. If you go to forbes.com/EJ Willingham or Emily Willingham, I think you can find it there. It's called The Science Consumer. I post as well. I'm the science editor at The Thinking Person's Guide to Autism. And I've had pieces that have appeared, Scientific American blogs, New York Times Motherlode blog, at Slate, Discover, and some other outlets like that.
So you're quite prolific.
Maybe dialing it back a little bit, that being prolific thing, so.
All right, Ben. Now on to our week of posts. So, Emily, what topics at XX Science this week caught your attention?
Well, I, of course, edited all the posts that we put up this week before I put them into the CMS, and every single one of them is worth a read, I can tell you, having read them. And the two that I think I'll talk about right now, one of them is by Jeffrey Perkel, who's our tech editor, and he wrote a post. It's called Unicorns and Brainbows, and that's B-R-A-I-N-B-O-W-S. So Jeffrey was writing about researchers who have created a kind of mouse that will produce proteins in the brain cells, and these proteins will fluoresce under certain wavelengths of light. The special thing about this mouse, and the reason it's called the Brainbow Mouse, is that researchers have found a way to get specific cells or neurons in the brains of these mice to produce different combinations of colors so that each neuron has a really specific color to it. Like one might be a darker blue and one a lighter blue, and they can actually create up to 100 different colors, one each specific to neurons. Why is this important? Because it allows them to trace the neural networks in the brains simply by visually following the colors for each of the neurons. They've just improved on this because the way this used to work is that the colors would show up only sort of in the cell body, but neurons actually also have really long extensions that then go and make contact with other neurons or other cells of the body. They've now got a technique that makes these proteins that fluoresce go to the cell membrane, which is all around the cell body and up and down these extensions or these axons of the cell, and it is a more intense fluorescence, and so they have an easier time than ever of tracing where each specific neuron goes in a mouse brain, which is really pretty cool stuff and opens up a lot of new ways to analyze neural networks in their natural environment.
Very interesting. And very pretty.
Yeah. The colors, everybody should go take a look at the post because there's some fantastic images in there. There's just really remarkable, lovely, downright artistic images in that
post. It relates back to both a post that Jeff wrote a few weeks ago and a podcast in February, I believe. So he really has a theme going on right now.
Yeah, he does. Definitely. Yeah, he's gotten kind of into his whole, like, the art of microscopy type stuff.
Yeah.
You were going to talk today about something kind of a little less savory, maybe not something you want to read while you're eating.
So our physics editor, Matthew Francis, gave us a review of Mary Roach's gulp called A Tour of Digestion from Nose to Tail. And this book is a new one out from Mary Roach, who's written several books, including Packing for Mars. And she's a pretty well-known science writer. In this particular book, she is looking at the digestive system all the way through, and there's a lot of stories that are used in this that are things that she did in order to research the book and the topics in the book. And the subtitle of the book is Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. And I have to say, I heard Mary Roach on several other podcasts doing interviews for this book, and she did perform quite a few interesting things. And you mentioned Scientific American earlier. I did listen to her review on Science Talk with Steve Mirsky, and they go into some detail about the book and some of the things that she performed, which, for instance, she looked at one of those cows that actually have a window into the stomach, and you reach in and you can feel the digestive system of where they store their cud, actually, because they kind of pre-digest and then kind of regurgitate it back up and chew for a while, and then so she felt one of those. She tried a number of other things, and this review by Matthew actually doesn't go quite as far into these things as I heard, but he does give a nice overview that you could read the overview probably while eating, but you wouldn't want to read the book.
Yeah. There's one part of it he gets into, and he says he made the mistake of reading that part while he himself was eating lunch, and he doesn't recommend it. But his review is actually itself a really well-written piece, and so I recommend people go check it out. And then, of course, get Mary Roach's book. She's just a fabulous writer. Definitely. So,
Emily, what was the other post that you were particularly interested in this week?
There was a new story that came out this week based on a study, and I think it had a lot of people kind of grossing out too, and that was about pacifiers and how parents treat them and clean them. And what the study did was it looked at differences in outcomes for children if their parents cleaned, quote unquote, a passy by sucking on it themselves, or they cleaned it by running it under tap water or by putting it in the dishwasher. And you know, the upshot of the study was that there were supposed to be differences in outcomes for the kids. And so the results for the paper, they found some differential results. And basically the way the pattern was is sort of that the kids whose parents boiled their passies or cleaned them really well had a higher risk for things that we consider to be allergic reactions like eczema or other things like asthma, and that when the parents sucked on their passies instead, there may have been, you know, the implication was that maybe the parents were giving their kids these microbial contaminated pacifiers. And this is supposed to trace back to something called the hygiene hypothesis. Our responses to challenges from the environment can basically break down into two categories. We either are mobilizing one part of our immune system to battle things like infections and bacteria and things like that, or we're mobilizing another part of it that's kind of like the allergy part of things to take, you know, battle things that trigger allergies in us. And the hygiene hypothesis is basically, we're so clean these days that part of our immune system that ought to be really busy taking on bacteria and stuff is kind of sitting around twiddling its thumbs. And so the part of our immune responses that sort of triggers allergy responses and stuff is kind of over busy and in overdrive, and thus people have more allergies. We're so clean that everybody has more allergies now, more asthma, more allergies and that kind of thing. Yeah, and so, you know, the implication study is supposed to be that because parents are sucking, you know, the parents who were sucking on passies, their kids had sort of less of these sorts of things. Maybe the parents are handing back their kids these kind of contaminated passies and challenging their immune system more than kids whose parents wash their pacifiers really well. But what Tara pulled out of this that seems to have gone kind of unnoticed in other stories is that one of the things that actually really contributes to whether or not a child seemed to have eczema, which is a skin response, an allergic skin response that can become kind of intractable and hard to manage, was whether or not they were born by C-section or born vaginally. And there seemed to be some kind of an association that, for whatever reason, for kids who were born vaginally, their parents were also more likely to suck their pacifiers clean for them than wash them. And also that these kids seem to have less eczema. And yeah, I don't know how relevant any of this is. And Tara does say repeatedly, this is a small study. And one thing that seems to have gone unmentioned is, you know, are they really looking at whether parents suck the passies and hand over parental bacteria? Are they basically looking at whether or not the passy stays nasty one way or the other or gets cleaned a lot? Is it parental bacteria or just the fact that it's still quote unquote?
I wonder if they even looked at, I know, for instance, my sister has six kids. In the first kids, it was sterilize everything and whatever. By the sixth kid, I don't even know if she managed to suck it before she stuck the passy back in the baby's mouth. So I wonder if that would be even a, you know, you'd want to check per child, even.
There's that, and Tara also pointed out that we don't all do the same, you know, we don't uniformly treat the passy the same way in all instances, and if I were to, I guess, drop a passy on the ground in the middle of Golden Gate Park where thousands of people are walking, I'd probably rinse it off. Otherwise, passies would just, like, drop on the floor of our home or something. I'm not even sure we did anything except
A child, another child found it before you did.
I know for a fact that our kids have just gone, hey, look at this passy, and picked it up and put it in their mouths before we got to them. So, you know, that said, they don't have allergies. So, you know. So there was a story out that seems to have also suffered from a little bit of misreporting, or a lot of misreporting. And this was about an alleged imported deadly meningitis-toting snail.
So this is a story that you actually wrote, Emily. And so you know quite a bit more, but there is this imported deadly meningitis toting snail, which basically, yeah, very much blown out of proportion.
So it's native to the southeastern United States and belongs there, and actually protects plants by eating other snails. So one feature of the snail is that it's that quote unquote cannibal and eats other snails. So they took it to Hawaii to get it to eat an introduced snail species in Hawaii, the giant African land snail, and I think you can see from what the story says what the upshot of that was.
Well, it's a cannibal snail, but then the snail ends up decimating about 100 species of the local Hawaiian snail. So, yeah, the importing a species, it may be native to the United States, but taking it from one area of the United States to another does end up in trouble. And I think we've seen this over and over and over again, actually, with any number of plant species and wildlife species and insect species.
It's like we're never going to learn. I mean, they took the snail, it's called the rosy wolf snail, to Hawaii to take care of the giant African land snail, and didn't touch those, and ate all the native snails, and it still remains a problem there. And it's completely reminiscent of, for example, what happened with the cane toads in Australia, where they introduced those, I believe, to eat cane beetles, and they didn't eat the beetles at all, and have basically just marauded the landscape in Australia and destroyed all kinds of native ecosystems, and are poisonous to pets, and there are just all kinds of problems with the cane toad introduction.
Yeah, that's the same with there's a Japanese beetle that ends up outpopulating ladybugs, and the Japanese beetles actually eat plants, whereas the ladybugs fertilize and help the plants, and so it's directly in contrast, and the problem is that ladybugs and Japanese beetles tend to look very similar. They're both red or orange with dots on their back. The same shape. So it's a number of issues. So
the biggest problem with any of this is that the introduced species that aren't, you know, didn't co-evolve in the ecosystems. For example, one example is hydrilla. These aren't things that necessarily we brought over on purpose. And so hydrilla is a plant that sort of was introduced in Florida. It's actually the plant that people use in their fish tanks. And they would empty their fish tanks in the waterways in Florida, and the stuff just started growing like crazy because there was nothing that was eating it and keeping it in check. And now it's pretty much marched its way all the way across at least Texas. And so to resolve that problem in Texas, they've introduced Asian carp.
Oh, yeah, and I've heard about the Asian carp problem.
Yeah, there's an Asian carp problem. They're supposed to be triploid, which means that they have three sets of chromosomes instead of two, and so they're supposed to be infertile. But, of course, you know, chaos theory should rule here, and, you know, if it can go wrong, it will. And they're supposed to be keeping hydrilla in check, and fire ants are the same. Their native fire ants are being outcompeted by these introduced fire ants, and maybe the introduced fire ants are eating the native fire ants' food. I can't remember which it is, but there are all kinds of ways that introduced species can just set everything
well,
in
the water. And it's one thing to purposely introduce a species, and, you know, there are steps being taken, I think, to limit the unintentional introduction when you're bringing something from one country to another. I know that when I travel back and forth from Canada, I'm not allowed to bring plants and stuff either because they possibly have pests that aren't in the United States, or the, say, fruit species themselves are not, they don't want them to be grown in the United States because those could then end up being, like I said, with the plants taking over or whatnot. So the snail's just a one story in many, although. All right, and could you tell us a little bit about the I Am Mental Illness series, Emily?
Yeah, we are going to be wrapping up the series in May. It's been running since January. We've been running a post every Friday from people who've submitted, some of them using pseudonyms and some of them under their own names, just as they chose to do. And the point of the series was just to bring out the realities of living with mental illness and do it in a way that destigmatizes it so that, you know, it's an honest look and one that so many people seem to have related to as we've gone through it. We have two or three more essays coming up, and like I said, we're going to close it out in May, which seems fitting because May is Mental Health Month, and so this month's posts are just a reminder that whether or not it's the month for mental health, there are a lot of people who live with mental health issues every day and for their lifetimes. In fact, a very large percentage of us do. I encourage anybody who is interested in finding out more to go check out our I Am Mental Illness series. It's on a tab at the site called Mental Illness. Just click on it and you'll see all the submissions.
We've had a variety of mental health diagnoses covered, and it's been very informative, I think, in many ways. Either as a person with mental illness, you can find something, or as a reader who maybe doesn't think they know anybody, but to sort of get a glimpse of what it's like and like you said, hopefully destigmatize the what it means to have been diagnosed with a mental illness.
Yep, exactly. And we want people to understand that these kinds of things are actually on a continuum, and you may think that you yourself don't have a mental illness, and you may very well not, but we all have our little shades of this and that, and you will find something that's familiar to you, I imagine, and at least if you encourage people to go read them.
Well, thank you, Emily. You can find all these posts at our website, doublexscience.org, by clicking on the links to the post on the main page. In addition to our Double X Science site postings, our sister site, Double X Science Junior, had three posts this week. We had Bon Voyage Neosat by a pretty regular contributor, Megan N., A Mystery of Salmon Migration and Magnetism, and The Development of Critical Thinking Outside of School. So, as someone in the Pacific Northwest, we love our salmon. It's just, I think it's like the Washington State fish.
It's very popular on this end of the nation, definitely.
So, it's kind of interesting to read all about their spawning and how they figure out how to swim thousands of kilometers out to sea and then back to the rivers where they were born. And that navigating and how it is related to the magnetic field of the local area. So those Double X Science posts, you know, range from sort of informational to a bit philosophical and are definitely a great read written by high school students. For our audience over at Double X Science Junior, it's geared towards ages about 8 to 16, but I think everyone can get a little bit out of these posts.
Yeah, go on over there if you're a reader at Double X Science and check out the posts and support these young students and writers who are putting themselves out there and being informative for the rest of us.
Yep. And you can find these posts at doublexsciencejunior.blogspot.com or by following the link from the doublexscience.org main page. Now on to our news. Emily, what science news have you been reading this week?
So I've read a lot of science news this week because it's kind of what I do, you know, when I'm not doing something else. But the story that really stuck out for me this week and seems to be just a perfect fit both for Double X Science and Double X Science Junior is the one about the 14-year-old who's presenting at a cardiology meeting, you know, one for grown-ups, not for 14-year-olds. She's presenting there a project that she did that actually did not win first place in her science fair at school, but she has taken it to this conference and actually has got some important implications for a lot of consumers out there who use iPads. And the reason is that her study question was, does the iPad 2, which is the one she used in her study, influence the activity of defibrillators that have been implanted in people with heart issues? So you may know of defibrillators as those paddles, you know, in movies that they put on people's chests and everybody goes clear and they go, and then, you know, it's supposed to zap the heart back into activity. Mm-hmm. They plant these kinds of miniature defibrillators into people. But the thing is that if you get them around magnets, it will stop them and then they have to they're supposed to restart is what they're supposed to do. Well, it turns out, and this isn't surprising to probably a lot of people who know anything about iPads, is that they contain magnets. And according to Apple, from what I read in the story about this, the accompanying information for an iPad says, you know, if you have some kind of a heart implant, like a defibrillator or pacemaker or something like that, don't hold this any more closely to your chest than about 6 inches. But this student who did the work, and it just so happens that I believe her father is a cardiologist as well, but her name is Gianna Chen, and she noticed when she was picking up an iPad that there were a lot of older people where she was taking a class on them and kind of not holding them maybe that far away from their chest. And so with her father's assistance, she arranged this study, and it was a study of 26 people who had defibrillators implanted. And these defibs have a mode that a magnet will trigger, and then 30% of them, when they put the tablet to their chest, it triggered the magnet. And so, you know, that's kind of important information for people who are walking around with defibrillators in their chest. And actually, I'm wrong. Her father is not a cardiologist. He's an electrophysiologist. So, and he was the sort of person who helped facilitate her work, because this is with people and it takes a lot of technical and approval sorts of things that you have to do. No 14-year-old can just go up to 30 people and go, hey, can I slap an iPad on your chest and see what it does?
Yeah.
But it was very interesting study, and she was only 14 years old.
And well, that she came up with such a question that is in fact important and is going to have health consequences.
Right. It will reinforce information, because how many people read all the information you get, right, with your iPad, and you go through all the small print and go, oh, I shouldn't hold this near my chest.
No.
So now this is sort of publicizing that, and there's this 14-year-old girl who's really done some good work, and she's presented it at the Heart Rhythm Society meeting, which only makes sense. So.
Well, that is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty nifty.
Pretty cool. Love to see things like that.
Yeah. Well, that wraps up our week at Double X Science. Thank you, Emily, for joining me today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for doing the podcast for us yet again, Adrienne. It's always great to get our stuff rounded up like this and let people listen to what we've been doing this week.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. In the future, we can look at topics on Double X Science.
Yeah, we've got some great stuff coming up next week. A friendly reminder to anybody out there that Mother's Day is Sunday, May the 12th, so don't forget your mother. And in honor of that, we have one post coming up that is about matriarchal societies in the animal kingdom, where the moms are in charge. Then we have a special follow-up post that we thought we might not should run on Mother's Day itself. We're running it the day later, and that's about mothers in the animal kingdom who eat their children.
Yeah, maybe not so great for Mother's Day.
Maybe we should run that one right on Mother's Day. Then also coming up this week, we expect to have a post, speaking again of mothers, on the rumor that women have sort of an unlimited supply of eggs in their ovaries that they could access if only we could figure out how. And we also have a post coming up by Laura Newman on what some of the effects of the Obama healthcare plan might be on people with disabilities. So make sure to check all that out this coming week.
All right, definitely. And thank you for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or a high-star rating at iTunes to help bring our science to more people. Our music is provided by Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. Our artwork is by Dallas Lopez. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at XXI. This has been Chemistry Editor Adrienne Rorick and Editor-in-Chief Emily Willingham. We are XXI Science, bringing science to the woman in you.